Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Do we need the laws to be like this? Are they doing what they're meant to do, but no more? Because we're in the realm of criminal law, sending people to jail. We need to keep these offences under tight review to make sure they're not being excessively wide.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Danielle Ireland-Piper, Associate Professor and Academic Director at the ANU National Security College. Today's podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples, and I pay my respect to elders past and present. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Jake Blight, the Independent National Security Legislation Monitor, to discuss secretly laws and how they fit into the national security landscape. Jake is the fifth independent national security legislation monitor and the first full-time appointee. Previously, I'm happy to say, he was an associate professor in the practice of national security law at the National Security College and has over 20 years of experience as a lawyer in the national security field. Welcome, Jake.
Thanks, Danielle. It's great to be back at the ANU.
Wonderful to have you too. Now, let's dive straight into it. What is the Independent National Security Legislation Monitor? And how is it different from some of the other oversight and law reform bodies we might be more familiar with?
Well, thanks, Danielle. It's certainly a long title, Independent National Security Legislation Monitor, and it is a little different to some of the other bodies. It's not really an oversight body unless you take that at its widest meaning. We don't do auditing or compliance. We don't deal with complaints. Really, the monitor's job is a law reform role, a bit like the Law Reform Commission, but much more specialised, just focusing on counterterrorism and national security laws. And it's a very independent role. I have a lot of own motion powers. I can choose my subject from a list of options, but I also get referrals from the Prime Minister, the Attorney General, the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence, and a few that are written into my Act as things I must review as well.
Thanks, Jake. And some might say that there are many lawyers, maybe too many lawyers in the world. Why do we need another one? Why is this role so important?
Well, it's important. There's so much law in the national security space. In the last 20 years, we've passed literally thousands of pages of national security law. It's complex law, it's dense law, and many of it is very unusual law. It changes fundamental rights, particularly in the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. We really changed the way the criminal law and investigative powers work. And those require some pretty specialized review mechanisms, not just the day-to-day application of them, but assessing whether the laws are still needed, whether they're still necessary, proportionate, and fit for purpose today.
I think I've even heard you yourself say, Jake, perhaps at the recent National Security College conference, that there are over 800 secrecy offences that are contained in our national security landscape. Is that right?
Well, it's more than 800, but it's across the whole Commonwealth statute books. There are hundreds in our national security legislation, but we've got secrecy offences in tax law, in social security law, everywhere, and they've been growing rapidly. The Law Reform Commission did a review in, I think, 2009, and there were 500 and something, and then the Attorney General's Department counted them last year, and there were 800 and something. So it's a big area, secrecy law, and I'm glad you raised that because that's one of the reviews I'm doing at the moment.
Yeah, and I guess that's the point to take, right? It's not like there's one piece of legislation called the Secrecy Act, which contains all secrecy provisions. They are, in fact, scattered throughout a number of laws, as are most national security laws. So I can see why there might be a need for an inquiry into it. What prompted it? What are the kind of legal and policy issues we're grappling with here, and what's the report focusing on?
Yeah, okay. So those laws are spread around, but there's a whole cluster of them in Part 5.6 of the Criminal Code. That's where the really heavy-hitting laws are, the ones with a 7 or 10 year jail sentence attached. And they're the ones I'm looking at, the ones that are in the Criminal Code.
And that's the Federal Criminal Code.
The Federal Criminal Code. They apply, most of them apply to Commonwealth officials, but there's also one offence that applies to everybody, including journalists, academics, civil society groups. And that when those laws were enacted, the Parliament, I think, was a little nervous about them, so they mandated that I do a review after a few years of their operation. So that's what I'm doing now. Looking back, how have these laws, which were made in 2018, how have they turned out? How are they really working? And when you put a really fine legal comb through them, what comes out?
I've taken a look at these offences myself, and even as someone who is a lawyer and who writes on national security law, they're very complex. And I guess that's because they're both achieving national security or seeking to achieve national security goals, but they're also engaging with substantive criminal law and some of the really technical aspects of criminal law, including things like intent and recklessness. Mm. Can you talk us through what the main effect of those offences in 5.6, what is their main effect and what do they do?
Well, it is interesting that you've raised that sort of interface with criminal law, because these, of course, are crimes. And most people who work in the national security space are not working on crime. I mean, our police and counterterrorism police do that sort of thing, but those who work in ASIO or ASIS or the Secret Intelligence Services, they're looking at security, and crime's not really their thing. So, for example, if you work in those agencies, secrecy is very important. There's policies, procedures, guidelines. There's classification words at the top of every document. You have to follow those. But when you translate those rules into criminal law, you're moving into a quite different field. So in criminal law, usually you're only culpable for your own actions, what you do and the consequences of your actions. Whereas if you work in the intelligence community and you're thinking about information, you're thinking about the mosaic effect, you know, what does this piece plus that piece equal? And that's a concept a bit alien to the criminal law. And you're also, if you work in those agencies, very, very well versed in what secret means, what top secret means, what sort of safe you have to put them in. But you translate that into the criminal law, and this is what they've tried to do in 5.6. In one of the offences, they've said it's a crime to disclose something that's been classified as secret or top secret. Now, at a superficial level, that sounds sensible, but then really put your criminal law hat on. You're saying it's a crime to not comply with a policy. Well, who sets the policy? The department sets the policy. That's not how the criminal law works. The criminal law is set by the Parliament.
And by that, do you mean who gets to work out what in fact is classified or not classified is ultimately a question of policy and therefore a bit unpredictable for an individual seeking to comply with the criminal law?
Well, that's part of it. But part of it is also the certainty. Laws are supposed to be clear on their face. You should be able to look at a law and theoretically know what you need to do to avoid a crime.
Right. That's a key element of the rule of law, right? The law must be knowable. Not necessarily known, but knowable.
Whereas actually at the moment, the law says, well, go to this policy, which happens to be on a website, except for the classified annex, which is, of course, not publicly available. So straight away, you've got a knowability problem. You've also got a certainty problem because the law isn't set by the Parliament. It can be changed at any time by, in this case, the Department of Home Affairs. And it's a fundamental rule of law thing. That's a bit of a problem. Doesn't mean the policy's bad. It just means it doesn't fit well into our framework of rule of law and our criminal law framework.
Right. And those offences don't just capture information that's classified. There's other categories of information, I understand, that might be a criminal offence to disclose too. What are they speaking to?
There's quite a few categories. And what's unusual is that one of them's a deemed harm category. So normally with a crime, you've got to do something that causes damage or harm. You assault someone or you do something that offends. Those are crimes because you have a harmful result. With a deemed harm crime, the Crown doesn't have to prove harm. Just if it's this type of information, you go to jail.
So in essence, it might not cause harm in actual fact, but if it's deemed to cause harm, a person will have breached the criminal law and be exposed to serious penalty anyway.
That's right. So one of the offences makes it a crime to disclose anything about the operations of our six main intelligence agencies. Now, of course, their most secret undercover operations should fit in that category, but at the moment, the number of pencils they buy also fits in that category, their day-to-day administration. And you've got this odd situation. Take the Department of Defense, for example. If there was an allegation of bullying or sexual harassment in one of the three intelligence bits of defense, you couldn't disclose that publicly without breaching these offenses.
Can I play devil's advocate with you here, though? Surely that person would be able to disclose that to the Inspector General of Intelligence Security, or if there was some misconduct, could they disclose it to the National Anti-Corruption Commission, for example? Why would there be a need to disclose this in public?
Look, absolutely people can and should use those avenues, but I think the right question is, when do we make it a crime to do something else? And we usually make it a crime when there's a harm. So if you were going to disclose something that disclosed that intelligence agency A had an operation running in country B, well, that would cause harm. That should be a crime. But if you're just going to say, look, I was sexually harassed in the workplace over a number of years and that's left me emotionally scarred, without any further details on what the operations were, why should that be a crime? Which I think is a slightly different question to, do you have other avenues for disclosing that?
So in a way, there would be a difference in the public interest in those issues. So there may actually be a legitimate public interest in the public understanding that there are agencies publicly funded where sexual harassment is taking place on one hand, but on the other, there may be other instances where the public doesn't need to know. Do you think there should be a public interest test in some of these provisions, or is that oversimplifying it a bit?
I think a public interest test sounds attractive, but it is a bit of an oversimplification. I think a harm test is a clearer one in the criminal law. Public interest is a very variable thing, but causing harm is a relatively familiar subject for the criminal law. So I think most offences should be based on harm or likely harm to things like security, defence, international relations, law enforcement capabilities. And the room that's left for deemed harm should be narrow. It should be the things that are always going to be harmful, like the covert capabilities of our signals intelligence agency or the timing of ASIO operations, the identities of those staff members. So there's a narrow range of things that will always be harmful. And, you know, if those who work in the agencies will know what that is, it's intelligence information and the ways you produce it. There's a bigger category that can be things that will sometimes cause harm. And it's true that sometimes, you know, procurement information will cause harm because it could reveal a capability, but it won't always. So you should have to prove harm in those cases.
I guess on your point that sometimes certain things will cause harm and sometimes they won't, are there any provisions in this particular area of the criminal code that require this to be done with an intent to cause that harm? Or can it be, for example, recklessness or a negligence? Or is it just a default if it was disclosed, even if you didn't mean to cause harm?
So again, this is where we think about criminal law. So there's always a physical and a mental element, and the default mental element is recklessness. So for all of these offences at the moment, it's recklessness. So if you're reckless to a document being classified or you're reckless to the harm occurring, and that's a little different to some other secrecy laws where the penalties are different. For acting recklessly, there's still a penalty, but for acting intentionally, there's a different penalty. So that's a good question.
Mm. I guess to that, you know, there'll always be a tension between secrecy and freedom in the national security space, as there should be from both sides of that coin. But I guess that would inevitably mean that your inquiry is engaging with a range of different stakeholders who have a range of views. How are you managing that different feedback and that balancing act between addressing the concerns of all the stakeholders?
Well, that's a critically important part of the role. And to be honest, one of the ones I'm enjoying the most about this role is it's really important that in protecting our national security, we don't forget the national. There's a lot of voices to be heard here. So in this secrecy review, obviously, I've had really good input from the Commonwealth Department of Prosecutions, the AFP, the Attorney Generals, but I've also had really good input from civil society groups like the Human Rights Law Centre, Law Council of Australia, Civil Liberties Australia, and a lot of engagement from media groups like Australia's Right to Know, Media Entertainment Arts Alliance, Australian Journalists Freedom, and a key group of academics working in this area who provided really useful input. So being able to hear all those views, and I've made all of them public, all those submissions are available on my website. I've held public hearings to be as transparent as I can. And that is, I think, how you get better laws with more input and a bit more time to consider different voices.
I guess that's particularly important in the area of national security law because, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's often bipartisan support for national security laws, give or take a few key issues. And so these sorts of accountability measures, I guess, are important in that sense.
Look, our Parliamentary Joint Committee does a great job, but they mostly hear from the agencies. And it is important, and they're often working very hard. That committee has a huge list of things, and laws are getting passed at an incredible rate these days. One of the roles of the monitor is to take that step back, take a little more time, look in a bit more depth. And I see I have a very positive relationship with the Parliamentary Committee, and I think that my role is slightly different to theirs. They need to do the first work, make a bill, make it into a law, and then I review it later on.
Why do you think that the committee generally only hears from agencies? I'm sure that's not deliberate.
Well, I think over time, and I think there's some – Dr. Della Pozza is doing some research on this. Over time, many of these other groups, they're not publicly funded. They're run by volunteers, volunteer lawyers, volunteer human rights advocates, volunteer civil liberties people. They've got limited resources. They put a lot into their submissions, but they can only do so much. And the timeframes in the committee is sometimes days or weeks for a submission. Now, the inside government, they know the bill's coming. They've had time to think about it. Outside, they've got incredibly scarce resources. They've got to target that carefully. And over time, I think, you know, they've lost some of the drive and ability to do that, both for funding and just there's such volume in this area.
So would you say then that this is an important role that the academy can play and an example of the nexus between academics working in the national security space and national security practitioners is that there's a role there for academics to take a greater part in making submissions to the committee?
Oh, I'm sure the committee would like that. I've certainly appreciated the submissions I've got from academics, but I think the committee would value that too. And some reviews more than others. You know, I've got a review coming up into foreign interference and espionage. I know there's some academics working in that area. I've got another one coming up we'll talk about later into certain surveillance powers, plenty of academics working in that area that I'd like to hear from.
Oh, that's great. You heard it here, academics of national security law. Start writing submissions.
We'll be right back.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
Now, in addition, of course, to having academic listeners, Jake, you'll know that our podcast audience also includes practitioners, interested in persons, and importantly, members of the Australian Public Service. Some of these provisions that we've been talking about that you're focusing on around secrecy and disclosure of laws would obviously have implications for public servants, even if they're not specifically working in national security. What are some of those implications?
Sure. Well, there's, of course, offences that are specific to national security information, but there's a general offence in this provision at the moment. And the department is doing a review. The offence at the moment is a 2-year offence for breaching a duty imposed by another law. But they're proposing to widen that offence considerably and have a new general offence that apply to all public servants who breach secrecy obligations. We haven't seen a draft of that bill yet, but I've come forward with some proposals for the kind of key principles that should apply. So when a public servant, and that includes contractors and others providing services, I think that offence should be harm-based, and it should be focused on things that are truly harmful to the essential national interests. Most other things can be dealt with by disciplinary and administrative matters. If you're a public servant and you do the wrong thing with information, you'll lose your security clearance and that'll probably cost you your job, and that's quite a penalty.
Yeah, and certainly would have a cultural chilling effect on the way we deal with information in the public service. You mentioned there that it would apply to contractors too. So what kind of people would that capture?
Well, the definition of Commonwealth official is quite broad. It includes contractors, subcontractors, and the offences apply to anyone who provides services to the Commonwealth, even if it's not under a contract. So it's a very broad range of people. Anyone who's doing work for the Commonwealth is on the insider side of these offences, and that's the heavy end. That's the 7 to 10 year offences. Everyone else, journalists, academics, civil society, there's a 5-year offence, but it's a bit more tightly drafted. It's more around specific harms occurring.
And how much discretion would courts have in imposing a sentence like that?
Well, courts always have sentencing discretion. So a 5-year penalty is always the maximum, for example, in a 5-year offence, but courts can lower that to a fine. They can lower it to a good behaviour bond. There's a huge amount of law in sentencing discretion. That applies to every crime.
Mm. And Jake, you mentioned before that this also, in addition to having implications for public servants and Commonwealth officials and so forth, that it also has implications for media organisations. Why is this particular inquiry into these secrecy offences important to them, and what are the challenges in their view?
Well, there's quite a few things they've raised. One of the first ones is that it's not only an offence to disclose information, it's an offence to deal with information, and that includes just receiving it. So at the moment, if you intentionally receive information, which might be as simple as opening an email or opening an envelope, you could have committed a crime. So if you're a journalist who works in the field of defence and you put it out there that I'm interested in defence procurement fraud and someone gives you a classified document,
you've
probably committed an offence just by receiving it. And I've said in my public statements that I think that's a problem. I think that someone who merely receives something shouldn't be committing a crime. What they do later, whether they disclose it, sure, we've got room there. But for non-officials, for outsiders, just receiving something, I've said already publicly I've got concerns about that. So that's one issue that media organisations have raised and they're very strong on. Another is to ensure that all the offences that apply to journalists and others are harm-based. Some harm must result rather than a deemed harm. And I'm very sympathetic to that as well. The third is perhaps a more general one, which is closer linked to whistleblowers than secrecy alone, which is more about whether there should be a general public interest defence. For whistleblowers, that's a separate review looking at that. But what you have in the criminal code is a defence for journalists if they reasonably believe they were acting in the public interest. And there's a few technical things in that that have been put to me.
Yeah, I can see how that would play out. And on one hand, of course, we understand the need for secrecy in national security work. But on the other hand, the media is often understood as the fourth pillar of government. And of course, a free press is an important part of our society and about how the public sees national security institutions and relationships and therefore institutional trust, I guess, too.
And that's recognised in other ways as well. So the attorney, a former attorney, and then this attorney again, has given a direction to the federal police in relation to taking into account the public interest in free press whenever they're doing an investigation. The attorney's consent is required for prosecutions of journalists. And then in the Department of Public Prosecution's own policy, they have to take into account the public interest. And that includes all of the public interest. That's including free press.
And I guess in some ways you've sort of already alluded to this, and of course noting that your report is yet to be released and we'll all be eagerly awaiting that. But can you give us a little bit of a heads up or a bit of a sneak peek spoiler alert about what your findings might be and what recommendations you might make?
Well, it's a little soon. The report will be out in June, but I think that those key themes around getting that balance right so that deemed harm offences are narrowed to things that are truly harmful, and that our harm-based offences are wide enough to capture, for example, the important international relations like AUKUS and counterterrorism financing arrangements, and ensuring that we're not penalising outsiders for doing things like just receiving a document. But the report will be out, it'll be quite detailed. It's a few hundred pages long. It'll be out tabled in Parliament in June. I'd be happy to come back and talk about it then.
And I guess the reason we need to do this, some might say, well, surely there are other checks and balances already in place. For example, we have in Australia an implied freedom to discuss politics that's constitutionally protected. Why wouldn't that be enough?
Well, there's the bigger question here is, are our laws necessary and proportionate as a whole? Not just do they meet the minimum constitutional requirement. I'm looking at our compliance with international law, our compliance more generally, but just that basic question of, do we need the laws to be like this?
Yeah.
Are they doing what they're meant to do, but no more? Mm. Because we're in the realm of criminal law, sending people to jail. We need to keep these offences under tight review to make sure they're not being excessively wide. And now they're certainly not being overused. There hasn't been a single prosecution under Part 5.6 of the Criminal Code. That itself doesn't matter. It still has effect. Saying that a law isn't used, therefore it's fine, has never been a good argument. We need to look at the law and whether it is worded the right way, whether its scope is right, regardless of whether it's actually being used.
Right. We don't want to wait for a change to an autocratic system of government before we take laws like that off the books. And I guess the other point, of course, is we don't have a constitutionally enshrined charter of rights. So mechanisms like this are really important. And even our implied freedom of political communication isn't an absolute right or a personal right. It's just a fetter on some exercises of power. And as you say, a lot of that goes to proportionality and reasonableness. And these are important things to visit.
Yeah. And for those interested in that area of what effect our lack of a constitutional right has, the issues paper for this review, which is on my website, has quite a detailed analysis of our Five Eyes partner laws, and none of them are anywhere near as wide as Australia's, and that's probably because they have those constitutional protections.
Yeah, it's a great paper and a really comprehensive one, and I do recommend it to readers interested in understanding more about the detail of this these issues and some of these complexities. So, Jake, what else is on the agenda? What other reviews might we expect in the upcoming future? So, for example, you mentioned before that you're able to choose your own topic of review. It can be suggested or requested of you, but you can also choose your own. So what's the choose your own adventure look like?
Well, before I get to choose your own adventure, I've got two more statutory reviews to do.
Busy.
One on espionage and foreign interference laws, which I think is very topical now, and that'll be kicking off as soon as I hand the secrecy report over. We'll be starting that one. And I'll be running a second review in parallel, which is about what's called the Slade Act, which is really about electronic surveillance and disruption powers. So three extraordinary warrants that were granted 3 years ago, one to allow police and ACIC to disrupt data to frustrate offences, one for broad surveillance power for criminal networks, and an account takeover warrant so they can actually operate someone's electronic account to gather evidence. And those three warrants are being used. They're not being used a lot, but they're extraordinary powers and exactly the kind that the office was set up to review. So those are my next two reviews. And then looking ahead to 2025, I'm probably going to be going back to some of the roots of the office, which is really around terrorism, thinking about our terrorism laws again.
Mm.
It'll be nearly 25 years since 9/11. It's time for a back to basics review there.
I read in a chapter that will be included in a book, Jake, that you also contributed to that will be coming out later this year and be the first overall comprehensive book on national security law in Australia. In that book, the author of the terrorism chapter pointed out that there are over 100 anti-terror laws on our books. Is the volume of law, as you sort of hinted to at the beginning, part of the reason why it's important to look at this? Or has times changed and these laws are no longer fit for purpose?
Well, I don't know until I've reviewed them. But, you know, we do need to think about what was terrorism in 2001 and what is terrorism now. And I think start from there, think about what that means. But we're looking long ahead. Between now and then, there's secrecy to be finished, foreign interference and espionage, and then these Slade warrants. You know, I have, I think, probably the most interesting job a government lawyer can have. It's a terrific role. I get to look at all these interesting laws, do the detailed legal work. I have direct access to the attorney, the parliamentary committee, and terrific input from government and non-government organisations. So there's a lot of work to do.
Absolutely. And a really interesting point you made then about the passage of time and, you know, whether laws are still fit for purpose and so on, because it goes to the role that law plays in society, including in national security society. So what do you think the role of the law is? Some might say, oh, again, you know, lawyers banging on about what lawyers bang on about. But why is law important in national security space? Like, why should we care?
Gee, that's a really big question. I mean, I think there's a couple of big roles for law in the national security space. Of course, law is the one main thing parliaments can do. Making laws is the fundamental job of our parliament. And making laws and speaking the importance of different issues is part of that. So some laws, just by the fact they're made, convey a legislative and a parliamentary intention.
Right, it's making a statement to society.
At the heart of our democracy. What should the law be? What should our society look like?
Mm.
In the national security space specifically, we've given our law enforcement and intelligence agencies extraordinary powers, totally unusual powers, and indeed immunities from ordinary laws. And that is a special thing that is needed to combat some very special threats. But we need to constantly review whether that balance is right.
Right. It's an active process. And I know you've written previously, of course, in your personal rather than your official capacity on, for example, telecommunication interception warrants. What are some of the issues there? I think I've read that article and I think it's a great example of why we need to be very active in the national security law space.
We do. I mean, our basic telecommunications interception laws were written in the 1960s. You know, the basic interception warrant was literally enacted in 1960 and it has not fundamentally changed. It's now 2024. The telecommunications system bears no resemblance to that of the 1960s. It's an area where our legal framework is deeply out of date, and that has both rights implications, because some of these things that were only a little bit invasive in the 60s are hugely invasive now, these basic warrant types, metadata, for example. On the other hand, there are things that the agencies need to do in a highly technological environment that trying to apply a law designed for copper wires is just very difficult for them to do, and things that they should be able to do. So both sides of that law are wildly out of date.
Yeah. I mean, Jake, you and I can remember when we had to pick up and dial a phone. Of course, that resembles nothing like an iPhone of today.
We do. And you know, when these laws were made, the most invasive thing you can do was listen to what someone said on the phone. These days, we hardly ever speak on the phone. Everything's in our data. You know, your phone data tells you more about you than probably your best friend can. You know, where were you last night? Whose phone were you near? Which apps were you looking at? How many times did you flick left or right?
What did you buy online shopping?
What did you buy online shopping? There's a huge amount in data, and there's a big area for law reform. That one is not one I'm tackling at Insulum. That area is actually under review by the Attorney General's Department at the moment. They've been working on an electronic surveillance review for a few years, and hopefully that'll be getting some momentum soon.
Mm. Jake, you mentioned what an interesting career this is to have. And of course, it can be a great honour and privilege to be involved in the making and oversight and discussion of national security law. What advice would you have for someone who would like to pursue a career like yours or in the national security law space generally?
Hmm. So, of course, when I was at university last century, we didn't have national security law. It wasn't even a thing. But I think now, if you're interested in national security generally, some legal studies will not hurt you, whether it's doing one of the national security law subjects here at the National Security College or doing a graduate or undergraduate law degree. So some understanding of law, some political science, and some human rights, understanding the bigger world, the bigger piece into which national security fits. If you just focus on the security, you can miss the national, and really both are needed. So I would encourage students to study broadly. And in terms of career, you know, my career started last century, but for those starting now, think about working in a variety of operational and policy roles. You do need to have both sides of that to get the best out of policy and the best out of operations.
Mm.
And of course, spend some time in an oversight or review body.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you say about getting the broader context, even if you're not a lawyer or not a practitioner, understanding the broader environment, because this is how we get, as you say, that bigger perspective and avoid things like the law of unintended consequences, where we're so focused on the trees that we forget the forest. So are there opportunities for students, for example, of national security or more broadly?
Well, let me speak selfishly about the opportunities I've got.
Please do.
So the National Security Legislation Monitor's office is small, and I only started in the role last November, but one of the first things I did was create two student positions over the summer. So for the 3 months of the summer holidays, I've got, and I'll have it again this year, two student positions for research assistants to be paid full-time, working full-time over the summer to immerse themselves in this case, whichever reviews I've got on foot, doing some research and thinking about national security law reform and review. So I'm sure Danielle can put something about that in the notes, but I would encourage people to think about that, think about other graduate opportunities. And remember, national security is a wide concept, lots of places in government and outside government to do work in this area.
And here comes our next generation of legal thinkers, which will be really important given the polycrisis the world faces now and threats like climate and of course, you know, geopolitical destabilization and what have you, having an interdisciplinary background could be really useful. So, Jake, I wondered if you had any final sort of thoughts or wisdoms to offer on secrecy, for example, or even on the role of the rule of law. This is a concept that lawyers talk about, and sometimes I think we don't explain that very well. But generally what we mean is that the executive should never be unaccountable. There should always be some oversight of what our decision makers are doing, and that the law should be knowable and, generally speaking, to find ways where the law will apply equally and not unfairly burden one section of our community over the other. Do you have any thoughts on that more broadly?
Well, that's a great summary of the rule of law, and I think it's probably useful at this point if I quote someone much smarter than me on this. Former Chief Justice of the High Court, Justice Gleeson, had a great quote on this. He said, "In our society, threats to the rule of law are not likely to come from large and violent measures. They're more likely to come from small and sometimes well-intended encroachments upon basic principles, sometimes by people who do not understand those principles."
And that old adage about the principles of justice being best tested in unpopular cases as well. That's obviously, you know, significant food for thought, Jake, and I look forward to reading your report on the inquiry into the secrecy offences and see where that goes. That's obviously a really important space for a lot of our listeners, and also to keep an eye on your upcoming inquiries as well, and encourage all those with an interest in national security law and governance and how we do it to keep an eye out and make submissions where that might be relevant to your work. Jake, I'm so grateful for your time today. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.